Triple-digit temperatures are behind us for the moment, but what a ride we had last week where even Eugene was topping 100 degrees. We get lots of warnings about what to do in the hot weather. Drink lots of water, reduce physical activities, wear loose clothing. But now we get a chance to find out what happens in the body when we spend lots of time in truly hot weather. It is a realm of knowledge well known to Dr. Christopher Minson, who is a professor of human physiology at the University of Oregon, doing some of his work at the Human Cardiovascular Control Lab. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Minson.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on the radio.
Tell us about the general work at the lab.
Sure. So I run what's called the Human Cardiovascular Control Laboratory, and part of what we do is related to temperature regulation. So I've been involved in temperature regulation research for probably the past 20 years or so. I did some early work for the military, trying to do what's called heat strain countermeasures. So in other words, try and keep some of the military personnel alive in the desert when we were prepared to head off to the Cold War. And that kind of spun into looking at more aging and how aging impacts temperature regulation. We've done some stuff, performance in athletes in the heat, as well as we're currently looking at how we can use heat to actually improve cardiovascular health.
I'm curious about the word control in the Human Cardiovascular Control Lab. You can controlling conditions or trying to control the body?
That's a great question, actually. And what I'd say more is we look at what's called the autonomic nervous system, and that's the kind of part of the nervous system that runs things you don't think about, like your heart rate and where your blood goes and those kind of things. And so we're really looking at how those parts of the system control where blood flow goes, how the heart responds, and that includes temperature regulation, so regulating how much skin blood flow there is and how much sweating there is. So human cardiovascular control is really where we're looking at the control of the cardiovascular system by the body.
Yeah, it didn't occur to me until recently to think that maybe part of the issue we have with hot weather is that we're talking about temperatures that get above the body's normal temperature. Is that part of the issue, or is it just a general strain on the body as it heats up further?
Yeah, again, great question, because that's actually a fairly confusing issue. You know, our body temperature is usually 98.6. It's kind of a classic number people refer to. So a lot of people think, well, if it's not above that, then not my body core temperature isn't going to get any higher. But the bottom line is any time we do any kind of movement or exercise, we only get about 25% of that energy that we use, have to burn from calories to do that actual work. And the rest of that, about 75%, becomes heat. And so we have to dissipate that heat. So you're correct in saying that, you know, if the temperature is above the body, absolutely you're going to be gaining some heat from the environment. But it's also a combination of if you're doing any kind of movement or your metabolic rate increases for any reason, then your core temperature can continue to rise also. It's really a balance between what you create in your body as far as heat and what you're able to dissipate to the environment.
Which explains, then, I would think, that why some older people have a greater issue with heat dissipation and not as active than at doing that. I mean, the body just doesn't work as well. Is that the general issue?
So there are probably two main issues there. One is purely just as people get older, their health tends to decline. So if someone has any kind of underlying comorbidities, for instance, they have coronary artery disease, they have some underlying heart failure, they have diabetes, they're going to have problems dissipating heat and allowing their core temperature to be released, release that heat to the environment. So that's the first issue. The second issue, as you mentioned, also is just that they tend to be a little bit less active, and we know that being healthy and active helps to improve your ability to lose the heat as well. So it's kind of a double whammy as people age, but they can do well in the heat if they are healthy and maintaining being active.
I was reading some of the materials out of the Human Cardiovascular Control Laboratory, and I was just shocked at the temperatures that people have been exposed to. I mean, people have been able to withstand temperatures how high?
Well, there's some really great studies from a long time ago where people were going into these chambers, and they're able to tolerate temperatures up to 250 degrees Fahrenheit, so well above the boiling point of water. They had to be protected from the floor, and they couldn't touch anything in the room, but they're actually able to stand in that room for up to 10 or 15 minutes reasonably comfortably. I mean, if you're moving around, you get the movement of air across, really hot air across your face, your skin, it can burn a bit. But they actually tolerate those temperatures. You know, typical sauna temperatures, you know, the dry saunas people go into, those are about 160 to 180 degrees. They're quite hot.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. We're talking about the human body's ability to withstand heat and ways in which we can make it better able to withstand heat with Dr. Christopher Minson, who is a professor of human physiology at the University of Oregon, working in the Human Cardiovascular Control Laboratory. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone anywhere in the listening area, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So given the high tolerance, if we can, it's just amazing to me. I thought it was 215. It's 250, 250?
That's the highest that we've seen. Yeah, quite about 30 degrees above boiling temperature.
Wow. So given that high tolerance, I mean, what is the basic problem for people in really high ambient outdoor temperatures?
Yeah, the biggest problem again comes down to whether they can dissipate the heat. So in those really high temperatures, the air is very, very dry. Humans are incredibly adapted to be able to dissipate heat through the use of sweating. A lot of animals don't use this, and it comes at a risk for us, because if you're not staying hydrated, having a high sweat rate, you're going to become very dehydrated, and then your sweating won't work anymore. So as long as our sweating mechanism can work, meaning we're healthy, our body can dissipate the heat through the sweat and generate the sweat, and it can be dry, it can evaporate. You know, dripping sweat does not cool you off at all. It has to go through that phase change from the liquid to the gas phase. If it does that, the cooling power of evaporation is quite powerful. So if you made those rooms, the high temperatures, very humid, now you're impacting how well you can evaporate the heat. So humans really do struggle when their heat dissipation by sweating is impacted in high humidities.
All right, so that explains why it feels so much more hot, even if it's just 90 degrees with 90% humidity in Miami versus, say, 105 but low humidity in Eugene.
Absolutely, absolutely.
All right, so they just can't evaporate the sweat off their skin in the high humidity?
Exactly right. So what evaporation is, it's just the water vapor pressure, and that's partly dependent on temperature. So your skin temperature rises a little bit, you can actually release the heat and convert that liquid water into a gaseous water. And that phase change takes energy, and that energy is released in heat. So if you have a high water vapor pressure in the air, then you're going to not be able to evaporate. That phase change can't happen. That's why if it's, you know, 90 degrees and dry out, you may not even notice that you're sweating, but you actually are. It's just coming out of your skin, but just evaporating immediately. But if it's 90 degrees and really humid, you'll notice you got your arms dripping and you can see sweat beating up on your skin, and that's not very effective for cooling.
We have talked about the external temperatures that people can stand in experiments up to 250 degrees. I haven't asked what the internal temperature is that becomes a danger mark for the body.
Right, and we actually have to tolerate within a very, very limited range of temperatures. So, you know, if a core body temperature is 98.6 normally, you know, if you're not exercising, by the time you get to 100, 101, you're actually feeling pretty lousy. Exercising, you get up that way and you kind of feel okay. But you start getting into the 102, 103 range. Those are kind of getting towards the more dangerous levels. But 104, especially for an adult, is quite serious, and oftentimes you'll start seeing things, you know, around the 102 to 104 range of heat exhaustion, people feeling really lethargic and not feeling well. Anything above that, you might get into the risk of a heat stroke, which is extremely dangerous.
What exactly happens in heat stroke?
Yeah, so heat stroke is basically where the cardiovascular system is starting to fail. You're not able to continue to keep the skin blood flow really high. Oftentimes, not always, the sweating shuts down. So sometimes in heat stroke, people's skin actually feels dry and hot, but it can still be kind of sweaty and still be in heat stroke. At this point, also, their brain is being greatly affected, so they're usually going to have a hard time making decisions. They're going to oftentimes be, you know, really unclear and in their speaking, and so it's a very dangerous situation at that point.
Well, that was one of the questions that I had then, was, you know, there are warning signs to watch out for in yourself, but it sounds like it's possible to get disoriented at the point where you really need to be asking for help or seeking it.
Absolutely. And this is one thing why we recommend whenever someone's going to be exercising in a hot environment, to really make sure that they are going to be telling someone where they're going, and better yet, to go with somebody else and make sure that they're, you know, staying closer to a safety zone. So if you're going to go hiking, for instance, and you're in a very hot day, I mean, first off, there's a lot of things you do. Carry water and let people know where you're going. Consider not going. Go earlier in the morning. But if you do end up finding yourself in that kind of situation, or wanting to or having to go out in those kind of very high temperatures, you know, making sure you're staying really close to a car, somewhere you can get safe, and certainly being with someone else is extremely important because people have oftentimes made very poor decisions because of the effects of the heat and end up not living after that.
The effect of heat on the body, our topic here on the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Christopher Minson, a professor of human physiology at the University of Oregon's Human Cardiovascular Control Laboratory. You can join us on the exchange with questions or comments about heat and maybe describe some things that happened to you when it got really hot outside. 800-838-3760 by phone, 800-838-3760. Email address jx@jeffnet.org. Wolfgang in, it's usually Sunny Valley, he calls it Smoky Valley today, says, consider the following facts. Nearly all hormone levels vary and fluctuate and cycle throughout different times of day or month. The interstitial differential pressures are rather marginal. Physiological blood pressure regulation is in part due to the volume of liquid reaching the kidneys and on. How can anyone possibly fathom that several degrees difference in the average ambient temperature could not have a major health effect? That from Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. So I guess what he's saying is it's kind of a no-brainer. If it gets that hot that fast, you really need to watch out for your health.
That's exactly right. That's very true. That said, again, if someone's healthy and they're staying hydrated because we are so dependent on having, large volumes of water in our body, our bodies are about 70% water. And so if that starts becoming depleted, we start having trouble. Cells don't work right. Our kidneys don't work right. Those kind of things go south pretty quick. Again, that said, if someone is healthy, especially if they have remained fairly active and maintain some cardiovascular health, they really can tolerate temperatures quite well. When you combine the exercise and high temperatures, then you've got much more risky conditions, of course. But what your recaller was referring to as far as the really, truly integrated nature of our cardiovascular system and all those things he mentioned, yes, they're very complex and they're very... But they're also, we've evolved over time to become quite good at maintaining blood pressure regulation and temperature, core body temperature, over a wide range of environmental temperatures.
Dr. Minson, we talked to Santiago Lorenzo a few years ago about his study on athletes exercising in heat. Were you part of that in any way, or was the lab part of that?
Yes, I was his doctoral advisor on that.
Okay, and what did it show that if you exercise in the heat? We're talking about high-level athletes here, right? I mean, I'm trying to remember what the findings were.
Right. We were talking about this was really highly competitive cyclists. For those who know cycling, they were Cat 1, Cat 2 cyclists, so not quite, like the type of people you see at the Tour de France or those kind of big races, but just below that level. And they were we were interested in trying to find out whether if you prepare someone for a very hot environment for performance, and people can adapt and do better in hot environments and exercise and compete in those environments if they prepare for them through repeated exposures. We're a little concerned that if you do prepare someone for those kind of competitions, that they might not do well in a cooler environment. So have you sacrificed doing well in the heat for a cool environment? But looking to the physiology, we thought, well, it's conceivable that we actually might see improved performance even in the cooler environment. So we did this pretty extensive experiment, which took over a year and a half to complete. This was Santiago's dissertation work. And we found that the athletes who went through the heat acclimation protocol, but not the control protocol, did improve their cool weather performance in addition to their hot weather performance. So it's quite a remarkable finding. It's got a lot of attention in the athletic disciplines.
Okay, we got a couple calls for you here. Let's go to Ann and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Christopher Minson.
Yes, I'd like to ask the doctor. I've noticed over the years that there's really a difference in when people start perspiring. People can be at the same temperature, same activity level, and some people will be perspiring heavily, some people lightly, some people not at all. I'm one of those people who don't perspire until I'm practically on the edge of heat exhaustion, but I do turn pink. And so I was wondering if getting that blood supply to the surface helps at all in cooling.
All right,
thank you.
Thank you, Ann.
Sure, yeah, this is an excellent question, and it's actually one that we receive a fair bit. As people become more healthy and more active, they tend to sweat earlier and they tend to sweat more. So like an athlete, for instance, or someone who walks regularly versus someone who is, hate to use this term, but it's fitting, I guess, a couch potato, the athlete and person who's more active is going to sweat a lot more, and again, a lot earlier as our core temperature starts to rise, just a little bit they start sweating. But there's more to it than that. There are genetics that play into this, and there's different, you know, just people are just different, individual variation. There are a number of people we've seen in the laboratory who just are not very efficient or very effective sweaters. And so, as your caller mentioned, they'll have these higher skin blood flows, and their skin temperature will get a little bit higher, for sure. But they're not they're sweating maybe a little bit, but not noticeably. And so they just are people who are not going to tolerate the heat quite as well as others, and then can perhaps chalk that up to individual variability. But the question really was whether or not she's still losing some heat. Absolutely, you're still losing some heat. It's just high skin temperature releases heat through convection or conduction, and it's just not nearly as efficient as evaporation.
Okay.
So that's the problem.
Sweating better, for sure.
Yes.
Let's take a call from Skeeter in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Christopher Minson.
Good morning. Do you have any idea whether or not excessive heat triggers atrial fibrillation in people who have AFib? Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure. I mean, AFib has a lot of causes of it, and certainly higher temperature can be one of the triggers for it. I wouldn't say it would cause it. I mean, if someone has underlying AFib, then certainly it could be a trigger to cause them to go into AFib. Higher heart rates, those kind of things can certainly trigger it. As a general rule, I wouldn't say just because it's higher temperatures that is going to directly affect the AFib in some way, but definitely having a higher heart rate can contribute to that.
All right. The concept of acclimation, I think you've already acknowledged, is a real thing. I'm just trying to figure out the mechanism here. The idea being that, you know, if it was 85 yesterday and it's 100 today, it feels really hot. If it was 95 yesterday and it's 100 today, it doesn't feel that big a change. So what's going on in the body to get us ready for higher temperatures as we go up?
Right. So a couple things happen when you get kind of chronically exposed to heat. And the example you're giving is a perfect one. You can look at how a certain day in the spring feels much hotter than it does the same temperature in the fall. Some of the things that occur is we do actually hold on to more body water. So as you get heat acclimated, you have more body water, you're more able to dissipate that heat, your thirst level isn't quite as great. Some other things that happen are we have these proteins in our bodies that are released called heat shock proteins, and they greatly signal differences in the body that can change our perception of temperature. And that's what we think is primarily going on in that case.
All right, heat shock proteins, another topic for another day. Dr. Christopher Minson is professor of human physiology at the University of Oregon Human Cardiovascular Control Laboratory. Thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you so much. It's very enjoyable.
All right, stay cool.